public health, privacy, and vaccinations. Tomorrow in Augusta, the legislature's Education and Cultural Affairs Committee will hear from the public on a bill that would tighten Maine's vaccination laws. Currently, parents can opt out of vaccinating their school-bound children by claiming a religious or philosophical exemption. This bill would end that. It is one of several bills being taken up by states across the nation this year. They are in response to growing concern over more frequent outbreaks of infectious diseases, such as measles and pertussis. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The World Health Organization recently named vaccine hesitancy as one of the top 10 global health threats. Social media companies have recently limited posts that spread false information. But some see the right to refuse vaccinations as a fundamental personal liberty. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Vaccinations are making deadly daily headlines these days, and we are learning about new studies on vaccine safety. There are outbreaks of measles and other diseases around the country. Here in Maine, a public hearing tomorrow will focus on a bill that would limit parents' ability to opt out of school-required vaccinations. Today, we'll talk about vaccinations, public health, and privacy rights. Joining me in the studio, Laura Blaisdell. She is a pediatrician and health services researcher with Intermed, who has done research focused on vaccinations. Frank Chessa is director of clinical ethics at Maine Medical Center. And Eliza Mehta is a healthcare attorney with Kozak and Geyer Law Firm. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have questions or comments about vaccinations? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. And Laura, you know, we're hearing a lot about vaccinations in the news right now. And part of that is because of the recent outbreaks happening, particularly in Washington State and New York State. Can you summarize where we are today, what we're seeing across the country?
Sure. Thanks, Jennifer. So, yes, we are seeing outbreaks of various diseases across the U.S. You mentioned the measles outbreaks in Washington and Portland that have created a state of emergency there. We also has have had five outbreaks of mumps in five states in 2019 already. And, of course, the ongoing pertussis outbreaks here in Maine. All of these outbreaks are representative of a threshold of community immunity that we have dropped below. And that is why we're seeing these outbreaks. And that is why we are suggesting that in Maine we need to make corrective action before we become the next state.
You mentioned that Maine, there have been cases of pertussis. I read that Maine has the highest rate of pertussis in the nation. Is that accurate?
It is true. Across the nation, the average rate of pertussis cases is 6 per 100,000 individuals. And in Maine, we're up in 30 per 100,000 individuals. And that is a notorious win for Maine and having the highest pertussis rate in the nation.
Okay. And before we move on to sort of the broader conversation about public health and privacy, I want to ask you just if you could please, Laura, explain to us the basics of how a vaccination works.
Yeah, so vaccination or immunization is one of the major pillars of public health. It's up there along with clean water, safe childbirth, and it's been around for years. Vaccination is the miracle of giving the body an opportunity to respond to a bacteria or a virus without getting the actual disease. And many of these diseases are exceedingly they cause exceeding morbidity and mortality, morbidity being disease, mortality being death. So the vaccines offer the body an opportunity to respond and memorize what these bacteria and viruses look like so that when people are exposed, their body is ready and prepared. And we don't have that waiting period where kids and adults get sick and oftentimes need to be hospitalized or in cases die.
Frank, we've been talking about some of the headlines around the country, and one of them is about the young man in Ohio who is 18 years old and chose to get himself vaccinated against his mother's wishes. And then also there are some states that are considering allowing teenagers over the age of 14 to be vaccinated against parents' wishes. Can you talk about the issues that a case like that raises? Do children have rights in a medical situation?
Hi, Jennifer. Yeah, that's a great question, and one that arises outside of the area of vaccination all the time, really. In Maine, our law says right now for most medical conditions, kids don't get to make decisions until they turn 18, and then their parents make decisions. There are some exceptions to that that have been kind of carved out so that the adolescent can go to their doctor and speak freely about things that they might be embarrassed or not want to talk to their parents about, things like mental health issues or sexually transmitted disease. So Maine carves out some exceptions to that, to allow minors to make decisions before the age of 18 for certain types of issues. More broadly, the way I think the recommended way to think about this is as a child develops emotionally, intelligently, and moves towards the age of 18, the child should have take on more and more responsibility for all aspects of their life, including medical decision making. So, let's say between the ages of 12 and 18, there really ought to be a shared decision making between parents and children about medical decisions, so that when the child does turn 18, they've kind of practiced making responsible healthcare decisions so that they're able to take on that responsibility at age 18.
It's interesting to me because as an ethicist, you're saying that between maybe the ages of 12 and 18, there ought to be shared decision making. But is there actually shared decision making?
So I didn't count the number of states that have a kind of shared decision making or mature minor law before coming in here. But, I'm going to say more than half the states try to feather in minors' decision making before the age of 18. Maine isn't one of those states, but many states do. I also mentioned that for research trials, federal regulations absolutely give mature minors the right to essentially opt out of research. So there's another area where those kinds of healthcare decisions are allowed by minors.
Eliza, I'd like to bring you in. Many states, including Maine, are looking at the question of who can opt in or opt out of getting vaccinations. Schools require that students be vaccinated, but sometimes people can opt out based on medical, religious, or philosophical reasons. That's a law right now in Maine that may or may not change. Can you talk about the history of these exemptions and how common are they? How did this come to be how it is today?
Sure, Jennifer. Thank you. So non-medical exemptions have been around since the 60s. Medical exemptions, I believe, have been around longer, and they're due to medical necessity. There is some medical reason for the child or the individual to not be immunized. There's some contraindication that some medical professional identifies. And in Maine, I believe you need to actually have a certified statement from a physician in order to be granted a medical exemption to Maine's current immunization law. As far as non-medical exemptions go, they kind of, are wide-ranging in terms of how they're structured and how states enforce them. Some states don't have any non-medical exemptions. Currently, California, West Virginia, and Mississippi don't have any non-medical exemptions. And the states that do have them have various ways of enforcing them and actually granting them. Some states are very permissive in how they grant these exemptions. So all you need to do as a parent is to write a statement to the school board, for example, saying, I disagree with immunizing my child based on my religious or philosophical beliefs. End of story, you're granted the exemption. Other states have significant procedural barriers in order to actually be granted one of these exemptions. So that's kind of the framework, the range of these exemptions, and I'm happy to answer more specifics.
Well, I know that in Maine we have some of the more liberal exemptions compared to, but in some of the states where it is, the exemptions are more narrow. Have there been court cases, and if so, what have courts found?
So I can think of one right now. I can look back in my research. They kind of come on both sides, actually. So I believe there was a New York case that a gentleman objected to not being granted the exemption he sought on behalf of his child based on his religious beliefs, and the court ended up siding in his favor because it found that the legislature had specifically included that religious exemption, and they would have chosen not to if it didn't want to grant them moving forward, and so it sided on his behalf. But the same is true of the reverse. You know, frequently, more cases than not, I would say, that I have reviewed fall on the side of the state, saying that if a parent fails to adequately demonstrate the specific place in their religious scripture that says you cannot be immunized, they won't grant the exemption, and that's upheld.
Frank, are the issues that surround vaccinations and exemptions similar to other issues in medical ethics? I'm thinking about maybe Christian Scientists who want to deny a surgery for their child, or others. I mean, where does this sort of this discussion stand in what you do and what you think about?
Sure. Similar but different, really. If you go back to one of the first major cases about this, I think it kind of lays out the ethics pretty well. So that would be Jacobson versus Massachusetts in around the turn of the century, 1905. But in that court case, the thought was, what does it take to live in a community safely, and what individual members of the community owe to the community, and what sorts of costs or burdens could be placed on individual members of the community in the name of public safety? So essentially, there was a Reverend Jacobson who did not want to get the smallpox vaccine, and the fine at that time was $5 for not getting vaccinated, and he did not want to pay it. So that case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and essentially what the justices said was that the interests of public safety, the interest of a safe community, overshadowed his interest in not paying the fine, essentially. So they upheld compulsory vaccination in that case, or at least being able to fine people for not being vaccinated, recognizing that, yes, that is an infringement on his free choice, and potentially there are costs and burdens associated with that, but those costs and burdens are less important than the sort of importance of public health.
Fascinating. That case is 114 years ago.
Yeah. You know, just as an aside, if you read the newspapers around that time, you see some of the same language that you see in the newspapers today and on the internet today about vaccines.
Laura, I want to put this into perspective just a little bit. My understanding is that very recently measles was considered eradicated from the United States.
Yes, and eradication is in the public health world somewhat of a contentious term, but yes, because and what we're seeing today is exactly why eradication is contentious, because these diseases have the opportunity to come back, and they will come back if we don't keep our vaccination rates high. It's a real tragedy of vaccines that they've been so successful. I think a lot of our individuals in our communities don't have the historical knowledge of what it's like to have lived through the iron lung of polio, which my mom had, to live in days when 30%, one in three children died in Maine and across the U.S. So if you can imagine looking at your kindergarten class and imagining a third of them gone, those were the days that we were. And so I think that we need to be aware and have a longer arching memory than just in the past 20 years.
Joining us now on the line is Maine State Representative Ryan Tipping, a Democrat from District 123. Thanks for joining us, Representative Tipping.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak.
Tell us about the legislation you have introduced and why.
So this bill makes schools and daycares safer. It removes the non-medical exemptions to the, as you discussed, decades-old immunization requirements. And this move is pretty widely supported by not only a sweeping majority of healthcare professionals and experts, but parents as well. The bottom line is our schools should be safe. And the vaccine hesitancy movement has damaged the community protections that come with high immunization rates. So what that looks like in our state right now is more than half the counties in the state have statistically fallen below the community safety thresholds on at least one disease. And public education is no longer cutting it. I'm not alone in worrying that the outbreaks we hear from across the country, the Pacific Northwest, Texas, New York, those have the potential of happening in the state. And I, you know, as hard as it is to read it in national media, I don't want those news of those breaks coming to the Bangor Daily News or the Lewiston Sun Journal.
Why are you including exemptions in your bill? Why are you including exemptions for both philosophical and religious reasons? I mean, really, most of the people taking this exemption say it's for philosophical reasons, correct?
Correct. But we want to make sure that these decisions are being made for medical reasons. The biggest problem in terms of people that are affected by the lowering of these immunization thresholds are people with medical problems who can't get immunity through the immunization process, or they've lost immunity due to treatments for cancer. We want to make sure we're basing these decisions and the safety of our children on sound science.
What options would people have if this becomes law, but they don't want to get their child vaccinated? Are we going to see more and more people, if your bill is passed, homeschooling their children?
Well, the bill is going to go through the committee process, and I'm sure they'll look at the alternatives and see how they want to change the bill. Right now, they would have the option of homeschooling their child if they want to put, if the alternatives to, you know, put other kids at risk by lowering the community thresholds of immunization for their local schools.
All right. Well, Ryan Tipping, thank you so much for joining us. He's a representative, a Democratic state legislator from District 123. There is a public hearing about his bill tomorrow at the State House, and we will hear from an opponent of that bill quickly after our break. But before that, Eliza, this is not the first time a similar bill has been introduced in Maine. What happened in the past?
So based on my research, there was a bill in 2015, I believe, that attempted to remove the philosophical exemption only. And I believe it passed in the House, but then died in the Senate. Now, obviously, that was a different bill in a different time under a different administration. But that is the track record we have for similar legislation.
All right. Well, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will talk with another state legislator about her opposition to this bill. We will take your comments and questions as well. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Fallbrook Woods, a Maine-owned assisted living community in Portland supporting the unique needs and individual styles of those with memory impairment. By UMaine's Collin Center, bringing Motown to Maine with the Four Tops and the Temptations, March 14th, collincenterforthearts.com. And Down East Institute, fostering innovation and economic opportunities through marine research and education, downeastinstitute.org.
A long-standing legal standard makes it hard to prosecute police for shooting unarmed suspects, which is a problem in the eyes of some politicians.
If an officer-involved shooting is deemed reasonable after the fact, that it is then justifiable. I believe that that standard needs to be changed.
Rethinking the reasonableness standard this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered coming up from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Did you know that if you do not have cable, it's still possible to see Maine Public Television, all four channels, The World, Create, and Kids as well? In many areas of Maine, you can watch all four of our television signals with an HD TV antenna. Will that work in your neighborhood? We've created a resource to help you answer that question, including finding out the likely signal strength where you live. Go to mainepublic.org for more information. Click on Television and Guide for Watching Over the Air. Or give us a call at 1-800-884-1717 and we'll send the information right away. With or without cable, Maine Public Television brings you four channels of the highest quality programming, an educational resource not to be missed.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, vaccination rights and public health. Joining me in the studio, Frank Chessa, who is Director of Clinical Ethics at Maine Medical Center. Eliza Mehta, a healthcare attorney with Kozak and Gayer, and Laura Blaisdell, a pediatrician and health services researcher with Intermed. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Calling now, Maine State Representative Beth O'Connor, a Republican from District 5. Representative O'Connor, thank you for calling in.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's a pleasure.
You don't agree with the legislation that we talked about with Representative Tipping that he's introduced. What are your objections?
Well, first, I just want to make it very, very clear. I am not anti-vaccination. In fact, I have four children. They are limited vaccinations over the years, my granddaughter as well. And the reason they were limited vaccinations was because we had the opportunity to sit and talk with their doctor. And so, like I said, I believe in some vaccinations. However, I think what really, really bothers me is I am anti-government force of my body or anyone else's. And I certainly don't want my parental rights usurped. So that's my real reason for being in opposition to this bill. I want to be able to make those choices. And I think many other families in Maine want to be able to make those choices as well.
So in your view, this is less about vaccination safety and more about the rights of the individual.
It is. It is about the rights of the individual, and it frightens me that we see so many government mandates coming forward. And I've read a lot about this, and I was really surprised to read from the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons that they strongly oppose medical decisions, including mandated vaccines, and they think that it should be the parents who are making these choices. So I think that we're taking rights away when we do things like this. And I listened to the representatives about increased vaccination, increased diseases because people are unvaccinated in the state of Maine. But the information that I've seen and I've looked at certainly doesn't appear that way. And we're above the number of individuals that should be vaccinated.
What would your proposed solution be to the competing sides of those who feel vaccinations are necessary to protect the public versus those who feel this is an individual right issue?
Well, I think what I look at, and I believe it's still in place, and it has been since I first started here years ago, the governor, if there's an epidemic or a pandemic, the governor of the state of Maine has the right to step forward and to be able to issue mandated vaccines for whatever that epidemic or pandemic might be. I don't see that happening right now, and I still question. I know that my kids all went to school. They went through school, and they never got sick. And the kids that I see get sick are the vaccinated kids are more sick than my kids have ever been. My solution would be to leave it as it is.
All right. Well, Representative O'Connor, thank you so much for calling in. Beth O'Connor, a Republican state legislator from District 5. Laura Blaisdell, I saw you shake your head when she said that about the American Academy of Surgeons.
Yeah, the American Academy of Surgeons and Physicians is not a representative group of physicians, scientific consensus. It's really considered an ultra-white, right-wing physician group. And they've also upheld and created several publications that are perpetuating the connection between autism and vaccines, which we all know has been firmly debunked. I also think it's using anecdotes, personal anecdotes, to make public health policy is not necessarily the most informed way to think about these issues of community health. It's important when we think about community health to put our own needs aside sometimes and think about the health of others. And lastly, I think the idea of getting to an epidemic of measles in Maine before we have some sort of intervention is just irresponsible. The costs of epidemics in Washington have exceeded $1 million in chasing down people who have been exposed, and not even mentioning the sicknesses of these children that were totally unpreventable.
Yeah, I want to talk about the other thing that Representative O'Connor talked about, though, and with you, Eliza, the legal side. I mean, this is part of the whole tension in our entire democracy, is this tension between private rights and public good. And this is in so many layers of our society. Do we have court cases that examine this very conflict when it comes to vaccinations and immunizations?
Absolutely. And I just want to touch briefly on the idea that private rights are being infringed by legislation like this. Of course they are. That is absolutely true. But that is justified, as has been demonstrated by both Supreme Court cases and state court cases. So
the courts consistently have sided with public health over private rights.
Right. And this is based on the 10th Amendment delegation of power to states. It's called police power. And it is the granting of general power to states to take certain state action that is intended to promote the health, safety, welfare, and morals of its citizens. And as Frank mentioned earlier, Jacobson v. Massachusetts, that's kind of the seminal case looking at the difference, or I guess the interplay between privacy rights and the, you know, the way in which states can intrude into those rights, and the Supreme Court ultimately held in favor of the state's intervention. That has been reinforced by several cases. I'm going to talk about two Supreme Court cases, and I'm happy to go into state cases as well. Zucht v. King happened, I believe, in 1922, and it narrowed the scope of that original analysis. This was not in response to a public health epidemic. This was a city ordinance passed to require school-age kids to be vaccinated prior to attending school. Parents were not thrilled with this. They challenged the constitutionality of the ordinance, and the Supreme Court upheld it, saying this is, once again, a valid exercise of police powers. The other case I want to talk about is Prince v. Massachusetts. This is not a immunization case per se, but it really digs into this conflict between parental and individual autonomy and the state's role in intruding into that autonomy. So this was a 1944 case, and the defendant in this case was a Jehovah's Witness, I believe. And she and her daughter were distributing pamphlets, and she was charged with violating Massachusetts child labor law. And her defense was that, no, we were just exercising our rights to express our religion freely. And in fact, your charging me of this is a violation of my First Amendment rights. And the court went into this fantastic discussion of basically where the line of parental autonomy is drawn. And that while parental rights are fundamental, as parents are the primary caregivers within the home, when children are no longer within the four walls of their home, when they are in the school, for example, the state does have a vested interest in protecting both them and the community. So that's kind of where the line is drawn.
We'll go to Kevin, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. So I won't be long with my story, but I'm a parent of an immune-compromised kiddo. Sam is now 5 and a half, but he had a transplant due to illness at due to a disease, enterovirus, at about 30 days old. So he was about 6 pounds when it happened, and extremely fortunate that he's still here with us, frankly. But his mom and I have to make a lot of really difficult decisions when it comes to his health, and they're constantly with us. So it's not something we can ever escape from.
And
some of those have to do. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Kevin, what is your message to the public? And I'm assuming you support this bill.
I do. And my message to the public is very much in line with what the most recent speaker, I forget her name, just mentioned. Just the general rule that as a member of a society, we do forfeit some rights. We do so for the welfare of the most dependent on the community. And we say the same with corporal punishment. You know, there's a debate whether you should smack your children. You know, what we found out is it's really bad for the kids if that's a public policy, that even light child abuse is child abuse. And I think in this case, I'm sorry, I've got to say it. You know, you limit your child's options later by not giving them the choice now. And in doing so, you're putting, I think, a surprising number of people at risk, whether they're immunocompromised because of something like Sam had, or just a natural disease, or poor health.
Kevin, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. I've read stories of people who have babies in these areas and in places like New York State and Washington State where there have been outbreaks, who don't even want to take their baby outside because they're afraid of them going to someplace like a Target or a Walmart or a ball game. and being exposed to disease. Do we have cases where, Dr. Blaisdell, where this has happened?
Yes, that, and it, actually you bring up a really excellent point of a major population that is unprotected naturally as infants who don't have the opportunity to receive the MMR vaccine, which is what we give at 12 months of age. And that is why we vaccinate children at 2, 4, and 6 months of age, because they're particularly vulnerable to the diseases that are circulating in our community now at unacceptable rates. Schools, in addition, are a community location that are not just where children are being educated, but it's where young families gather. If you picture the pickup outside my public elementary school, there are families with babies on their chests and in strollers. And this is also a public function of schools that infants who are less than the age of 1 or 2, we need to be vocal advocates for, because they can't advocate for themselves.
Coco on Facebook writes, I'm wondering if this topic has to be a binary issue where the rights of one group outweigh the other. Does your panel have any experience or ideas around alternative, creative, third option solutions that could both uphold public health and maintain the rights of those who are religiously or philosophically opposed to vaccines?
That's a great question. And I wish I had a creative way to respond to it. I will say that to kind of normalize the discussion we're having, there are many, many areas that we sort of come up against in society where we're sort of debating, okay, we know that we want, you know, to live in a free society with as many options as possible. And we want people to sort of be able to define their own good and live their own lives freely. At the same time, we know that we live in close proximity to each other. We share all kinds of resources. We all use the same roads. We all want to go to the same baseball games or whatever. So we all want to congregate. And so how do we balance that sort of those issues of public safety against individual rights? You know, even something as simple as getting our cars inspected to make sure they're safe. So there's a burden there. Potentially, I want to drive a car that's a little older and harder, you know, harder to make safe. On the other hand, when I'm on the roads, I want to make sure that I'm driving besides vehicles that are safe. So in all kinds of different spheres of our lives, we're having this discussion. And there often are no easy answers.
Eliza?
I think that looking at the nation as a whole is a wonderful way to kind of explore that question. And so as states, we are basically laboratories of experiment. We get to play with the language of our laws to try different things. And so across the country, we have very different approaches to how we try to maintain appropriate levels of immunization and how we try to be as permissive to individual rights as possible. And so I think just looking at how states approach this issue and then looking at their relative immunization rates and outbreak rates is a really good way to explore that issue further.
We now have on the line Matt Hogenauer. He's a senior at Falmouth High School. Thanks for joining us, Matt. And I understand you've written an op-ed about vaccinations from the perspective of a student and as someone who is immunosuppressed. Can you tell us your story a little bit and why you felt compelled to write about it?
Sure. So first off, thank you for having me. And so I guess there's sort of two origins for this story, or two origin points. The first is, so my sophomore year of high school, towards the tail end of it, I ended up getting pertussis despite being vaccinated against it. And, you know, we believe that this is in part due to my being immunosuppressed, and because the medications that I'm on interfere with the way that my immune system functions, we believe that that also impairs the effectiveness of the vaccinations that I've had. And so that, you know, that was sort of the starting point for me, at least getting talking to my mother and father, who are both physicians, and my biology teacher, who's been, you know, a mentor to me. And she was the impetus for the second origin point of this story. So she's been working with Dr. Blaisdell, you know, campaigning for, you know, legislation that increases Maine's vaccination rates. And knowing that this was an issue that I was passionate about, and knowing that this legislation you know, is being looked at and is being scrutinized. She suggested that I sort of tell my story and I try and get that story out there so that people can understand where I'm coming from as somebody who's, you know, who's put at risk by people who don't vaccinate.
Matt, what has been the response to your op-ed?
So the response was mixed. There were people who were very supportive and who, you know, who really welcomed the message. And there were people who didn't support the message, but respected the fact that I was willing to speak about my experience. And then there were people on the other end of the spectrum, which was just, just unkind and angry. And, so that was a little bit disappointing, but, I understand that it's an issue that a lot of people are very passionate about. I had just this morning, an article that I was involved in and interviewed for, was published in the Portland Press Herald. And, one of the comments I read was something along the lines of, you know, a suggestion that because I'm immunosuppressed, I shouldn't pursue, you know, my dream of becoming a physician. It's run the gamut from people who are wholeheartedly supportive to people who just seem to sort of be lashing out angrily because I oppose what happens to be their viewpoint.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for calling in. Matt Hogenauer, a high school student who is immunosuppressed. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Diversions Puzzles and Games, committed to offering fun, social, and technology-free ways to connect at Hannaford Plaza by Maine Mall and in downtown Portsmouth. And Marshall Communications PR Maven podcast with industry leaders, executives, media, and online influencers. PRmaven.com.
I'm Greg Dalton. On the next Climate One, the basics of climate science explained.
When we put CO2 into the atmosphere, it's like a blanket around the surface of the Earth. And we're switching now from a lightweight summer blanket to a down comforter. And that effect is cranking up the temperature of the planet.
If that's the case, then why is it so cold outside? Climate change and winter weather on the next Climate One.
Coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public has a powerful educational resource for teachers here in Maine, PBS Learning Media. Learning Media is an on-demand media service for educators that provides easy access to a wide range of classroom-ready, curriculum-targeted resources for grades K through 12. Why not check it out? Go to mainepublic.org for more information and to explore this free educational resource.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking about vaccinations. Here with me, Eliza Mehta, who is a healthcare attorney, Laura Blaisdell, a pediatrician and health services researcher, and Frank Chessa, medical ethicist. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. I want to talk a little bit about the vaccine information statement, which is, I understand what the piece of paper is called. Laura, I think that this is confusing for many parents because we hear that it's so important to get our children vaccinated. We listen to pediatricians like you. And then when it's about time to get those shots, we're handed a piece of paper. And on that, it has a phone number that if your child is injured by a vaccine, you call this number. That is really a mixed message. How often are children injured by vaccines?
So it's not necessarily a mixed message, but it is the responsibility that we have as pediatricians uniquely whenever we prescribe any medication or give any intervention is that we need to know what the possibilities are. I think another way to frame this question is to ask, do the benefits of vaccines clearly and definitively outweigh the risks that are outlined in those vaccine information statements? And the answer is, assuming that you don't have a medical contraindication for vaccination, it means yes, the benefits do definitively outweigh the risks, but that doesn't mean that there is no risk. We know that vaccines, often there are redness or pain at the injection sites. A few vaccines can cause fevers and sometimes very high fevers. And when parents have high fevers, about 10% of the population could have a febrile seizure from vaccines. And although febrile seizures have no long-term lasting effects, they're exceedingly scary to go through with parents, to watch parents deal with that side effect. Rarely, vaccines do cause more severe side effects. We know that the oral polio vaccine caused polio itself in 1 in 2.4 million cases. We know that the 1976 swine flu vaccine was found to be a rare cause of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an ascending paralysis in 1 in 100,000. And we know that some people have very rare allergies to vaccine components, whether they're stabilizers or egg proteins. But we do know that, and we know that because we study vaccines very carefully, and we don't give them without a sound and sound knowledge of what we are doing when we recommend them. I think the decision to leave your child is also unprotected is also not risk-free. And as we lose our community immunity and these diseases start returning, it means that the unvaccinated child is no longer protected enough by enough vaccinated children to prevent outbreaks. So that's a very long answer, but the benefits do outweigh the risks that are on those sheets.
So your point is that the risk calculation is changing, and it's changing this year as we see more and more outbreaks.
Exactly. I mean, the risk for an individual's effect from a vaccine is not changing, but the overall risk, so that's my pediatric risk, but my public health risk is changing rapidly.
And your child's risk of contracting something like pertussis and measles is much higher than it was even last year or the year before.
Very true.
All right, we're going to go to Melinda, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Melinda, go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. This conversation sort of highlights to me what is very common with this conversation around the country is this panel is very one-sided. I really wish you brought somebody from the Maine Coalition for Vaccine Choice on to this conversation, because this is a very one-sided conversation right now. And I feel like that's sort of the party line out there, is that there's a bunch of anti-vaxxers, which is kind of an epithet that actually was created by the pharmaceutical industry themselves, to polarize. And I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I was fully vaccinated as a kid. My daughter is moderately vaccinated, extremely healthy. And I feel like we are at a place right now in Maine. I know we're at a place in Maine, though obviously it's different from county to county with the rates, but Maine is above the herd immunity percentage. And so I'm sort of curious why we now have this sort of draconian extreme bill being introduced at a time when vaccination rates are at an all-time high. I have deep concerns about, you know, you say, oh, well, we take great care in looking at whether a child could potentially be injured by a vaccine, but you don't really know that, especially with infants. And I am a functional nutrition practitioner and a health coach, among other things. And one of the tenets I work with is bioindividuality. And that is absolutely as imperative here as it is, you know, more so than when I'm talking to somebody about food and what they're, you know, taking in for food that could be a problem for them. There are so many ingredients in vaccines that could be harmful for various people.
Sure. You've raised a few points, Melinda, and I want to bring up a couple of them. Dr. Blaisdell, she said that vaccination rates are at an all-time high. Is that in Maine? Is that true?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for sharing your opinions. I do believe that you have a very important voice to hear, and so I do appreciate and respect your opinion. But I do respectfully disagree with you about vaccine rates. We know that the philosophical opt-out rate in Maine is up 5% from 3% in 2005. So that is unfortunately not true, and that is the reason why we're facing this debate now.
All right. And Melinda, you have the same question that somebody else does, and I'm trying to find it here on my screen. But people talking about the other ingredients in the vaccinations, our tweet that's on my screen asks, is there somewhere people can go and find a list of the ingredients in vaccinations if they're concerned about them?
Absolutely. The CDC publishes lists of the ingredients in vaccines, and I encourage every person to talk with their physician about those ingredients, because understanding whether those ingredients are harmful or not. So sodium chloride sounds a little scientific and technical, but it's actually salt water. So it's important to put the vaccine ingredients in appropriate context with your healthcare provider.
All right, Melinda, thank you so much for your call. We're going to go to Pat Endersley right now. She is a school nurse at Wells High School, and she is president of the Maine Association of School Nurses. Hi, Pat. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What are schools seeing across Maine?
Well, I think basically it depends where in Maine you are. You know, as we said, we have some districts where the, I know up on the mid-coast, some exemption rates are up as high as 15%, not so much here down in southern New York County. So, you know, we talk about the, you know, the overall herd immunity of the state may look good, but when you look in specific regions and, you know, some, you know, parents, when they turn in their philosophical exemption, will say to me, well, I'll keep my kids home when they're sick. But the problem is we're finding is that you're spreading virus and whatever you're sick with before you know you're sick. So, and this is the trouble, you know, what Dr. Blaisdell was saying about, you know, with the infants and public gatherings and that type of thing.
I'm wondering if there's an action plan that school nurses are having to develop with the outbreaks around the country. Are you having to think about what do we do as school nurses and what is our school department's action plan if and when there is some sort of outbreak?
Absolutely. The influenza H1N1 taught us some great lessons. And actually, since the H1N1 outbreak in 2009-2010, our district and many other districts have been doing immunization clinics for the flu, not required for school, of course. This is totally voluntary, but it's just kind of a good example about how we can mobilize to do this. So what we do as a general rule is school nurses are asked to keep lists of, you know, your students who are not immunized. So if there is an outbreak of varicella chickenpox, if there's an outbreak of pertussis, those students would be excluded. And the Maine CDC, we always go by there. They work with schools. So if there's an outbreak, they tell us what to do.
All right. Well, Pat Endersley, thanks so much for calling in. I hear the school announcements behind you.
End of the day.
Pat Endersley is a school nurse at Wells High School and president of the Maine Association of School Nurses. We're going to go to Jared calling from Rockland. Hi, Jared. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes. Thank you, Jennifer. I just wanted to thank you for covering this today. And you hear a lot about people who you're talking a lot about the herd immunity, but I don't think it's always made clear that that really the people who are protected by vaccines aren't necessarily 100% protected, and it's really the vaccines only work when as many people as possible are vaccinated, and people who think they get some sort of benefit from keep remaining unvaccinated are really getting that benefit at the expense of everyone who is, and sort of taking their freedom away by choosing to not be vaccinated.
Sure, Jared. Thank you for your call. And Frank, the point he's making is that because vaccinations are not 100% effective, that we have to have more than a certain number of people vaccinated to
sure
make herd immunity work. Yeah. I'm trying to think of the right phraseology here.
So I saw two points. One is that I think about 97% of people, it varies according to the vaccine, percent of people who are vaccinated with a particular vaccine get the immunity. There's 3% where essentially the vaccine doesn't take, so they're open. So those folks are at risk in addition to the people who aren't vaccinated because they're immunocompromised. I think the second point he was making was that if you choose not to be vaccinated because you think it sort of benefits your health and you live in a place where their herd immunity is high, you've kind of benefited at the expense of everybody else. It's often called in philosophy the free rider problem, and it's an issue because if too many people try to take advantage of that of being a free rider, obviously the herd immunity would drop and nobody would get the benefit. So so it's often often posed about, you know, what's the responsible thing to do? Is it to sort of benefit at the expense of everybody else? I'll say that the analogy doesn't work perfectly here because I'd argue that I think that not being vaccinated, while it may be perceived as a benefit for some in a community where there's herd immunity, I think it still puts you at increased risk of becoming infected with one of these diseases. So I'm not so sure that remaining unvaccinated is a benefit to the kids, even in a place where herd immunity is pretty high.
Well, Jared, thank you for your call. An email from Terry: how long do vaccinations last? Will adults be required to get booster shots? And it seems, what I have read, many people who have gotten sick in recent outbreaks actually have been vaccinated. How well do they actually work? These are the questions I'm sure you're getting from your patients all the time, right?
It's true. We don't have enough time to talk about how long vaccinations last for each vaccine that is out there. But we do know that some vaccines do wane in their immunity, pertussis being one of them. I do not believe that there are adults who are being mandated to be vaccinated by this law. The exclusion would be healthcare workers, which we all vaccinate ourselves so we can protect our patients. And that's part of the integrity of being a healthcare provider. The last part of that question, Jennifer, can
you remind me? Well do they actually work?
How well do vaccines work? They work incredibly well. How many outbreaks of polio have we seen in the last 10 years? How many outbreaks? And these outbreaks are so shocking because vaccines have worked so well.
Hmm. Wondering, Eliza, if you have any final thoughts about just this overarching issue of the tension between private rights and public health that we're seeing played out right now in the vaccination debate.
Sure. I think the takeaway from this conversation in broad strokes is that the Supreme Court has all but said that in this sort of situation, state initiatives to protect the public health, the common welfare in schools and elsewhere is going to be primary to individuals' rights. And so this basically means that any state that grants religious and philosophical exemptions is going above and beyond what the Constitution requires. That's completely fine. And as people who have elected our representatives, we get to be part of that process of determining what we want to allow to be passed into law. And so if you're interested in getting involved in the discussion, tune in to the public hearing tomorrow.
All right. Well, thank you all for being here. And I apologize to anyone whose question we didn't get to. As you might imagine, a lot more questions and comments than we had time for. That was Eliza Mehta, a healthcare attorney with Kozak and Geyer Law Firm. Dr. Laura Blaisdell is a pediatrician and health services researcher with Intermed. And Frank Chessa, Director of Clinical Ethics at Maine Medical Center. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.